This is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on today's episode is Rabbi Shifra Tobachman. Rabbi Shifra, it's really good to have you here this morning, and thank you for being willing to be with you, Eric.
Thank you for inviting me.
So the way the show begins is with a huge question, and it's an opportunity to kind of for you to paint in broad strokes the characters or the qualities of your life that give us a place to start. You know, who are you? What do we need to know about some of the things you aspire to, that you value, that you've done? This is not about credentials. It's about your personhood. What do we need to know to start this conversation?
That is a big question.
Yes.
Well, from what conversations I've had with you before, I shouldn't be surprised by a big question. And I know it's one you sent to me in advance. I tried not to think too hard about the questions in advance, to be frank.
Yeah.
So that I could give something honest in the moment here. What's important about that people know? Well, I'd say that the things that seem to keep coming up when I investigate questions like this are one that I seem to do well when I think of myself as a poet.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that I write poetry all the time, because unlike poets who really dedicate their lives to their craft, I don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
I do write poetry. There's a way that I've noticed over time that I think associatively and that metaphorically often, and that I associate that in itself with being a poet, having a poetic approach to things.
Right.
It's not the only way I approach things, but it is important.
And poetry is a version of language that keeps you attached to the pace and the rhythm of things. So it moves. And we often think of poets as people who are sedentary, but poetry is meter, poetry is rhythm, poetry is a quality of engagement. And I think that's what you're saying.
Yes, I think I'm saying that. Yes, yes. It's a way of engagement, and it's a way of thinking about things in the world. And I'm looking outside my window right now. I just moved to a new house, and my house has a big picture window that looks out onto woods. I've never lived in a place like this. I've lived mostly in cities.
Mm-hmm.
This is my first time living in a place like this. And so, you know, I'm noticing both the ways that slows me down that I love, and also the ways that I need to pay attention. Because I'm also a person who cares deeply about engagement in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Since I've been young, I've cared a great deal about social change and social justice issues. I'm noticing that there's a tension.
Right.
Between living in such a place and wanting to fully take it in and enjoy it and engage
mm-hmm,
with it,
mm-hmm.
and wanting to have this and wanting to make sure that doesn't keep me isolated or separated in some way, that I don't allow myself to become isolated or separated in some way from the needs that the world is so desperately calling us to at this time. And so I have always thought so I also think of myself as someone who cares about healing and repair.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so, and the way I have always seen that is that's both very, very personal and individual. Mm-hmm. And very, very global, and everything in between.
Right. And poetry gets at both of those things. Poetry is action and perspective.
Exactly.
And you use as a quote on your email, I think, from one of my old professors, justice is what love looks like in public.
Yes, Dr. Cornel West. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, you got to study with him.
Oh,
Lucky
yeah,
you.
right after he got it, shortly after he got his PhD when he was teaching at
Oh,
Union. His first full time semester there. And his last full-time semester there before going off to, I don't know where he went to, Harvard, Yale, I don't know where he went to. He's been around a lot. Anyway, so yeah, no, and the repair, and how it's both personal and universal. Those are
right.
powerful images.
So there was a period of time where I thought that I would be, or I thought that I would be a healing practitioner, and I was a massage therapist for a number of years and a Feldenkrais practitioner, which is a kind of neuromuscular re-education and movement re-education. And I did that for about 10 years after being a community organizer. And again, you know, in my mind, like to other people, it might have looked like, well, that's an odd transition. But to me, it was like, well, no, not really. You know, I went from thinking about communities and what makes them work better and, you know, how people can have what they need and in a world that's not treating them, not giving them what they should by rights have, as humans, as human beings. And
You
I
went from the
spent,
organizing to the personal, to the individual.
yeah, the personal. And, you know, in between, I tried a bunch of other things. So,
Neat. And now you're a rabbi.
now I'm a rabbi, and that's after a long career in health education and public health. So, and to me, these things have always seemed connected. It's never seemed like a jump. It's always just seemed like an evolution to me.
Right.
You know, unfolding of life.
And the health of our community of relationships is also often predictive of our own individual health and vice versa. So I think you're on to that. And that's why I went to seminary in the first place, was to do holistic community development, because I could have gone to medical school or law school or grad school in anthropology, but I wanted to have access to all dimensions of people's lives. And in the spiritual community, you have access if you earn it, but you have to earn it.
And that takes time because relationships take time, right?
Literally decades, but years at least, but usually decades. So Schiffer, what should we open? What music should we start the show with?
Would you mind if we opened it with my poem?
Yes, go right ahead.
And this is a poem that evolved actually over time a bit. So,
I noted that it was written in 1990 and then it evolved over the next 30 years.
I think of it a bit as an anthem. But I noticed before I sent it to you, I did a whole mess of fussing with it. And now I'm looking and thinking, so which one am I going to read? The one. I'll find out. We'll find out. It's called chances. We run and jump and leap and fall. We jump high and fall far. We turn and turn and turn and dizzy fall again. We get up and jump and leap, and it's all simply us. There are no words for the risks we take. We take them because not to is a kind of death, and we are lucky to be alive in this world, rife and ripe as it is with chaos and possibilities at many crossroads and our own crossroads, having brought us by necessity here right now. We kick down metaphorical windmills at which we might have tilted in the past and leap as if walking into real battles, but without real malice or revenge. There is a straightforward anger, as apparent as joy at a beautiful sunset, a transient fear that needs our attention, yet with which we don't want to linger too long. Not unlike melancholy at the absence of a love long gone. We reflect these in each cell, which is different from knowing that they are there. We do them, we are not them, and still they are a part of us. Perhaps it's Shekhinah we're noticing in these moments, the indwelling divine presence, evident in the earth around us and within our own being. Life that encompasses and doesn't overwhelm, life that inhabits and doesn't overcome. The same life that inspires passion and awe and still remains nestled in our mind's eye. The same life that inspires passion and awe and still can simply allow us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to let that poem stand as a commentary on your introduction and an anthem to what comes as you had given it. And it's a very straightforward lead into my next question. Given the life that you value now, what were some of the core experiences, the core lessons you needed to learn to know how to live it?
Oh, wow. Oh my goodness, there are so many.
And we have time. We have time. We can spend the whole show exploring this question we have in the past.
Well, the biggest one is that I don't know very much, I think, is learning that I don't know very much. For some reason, it took me a long time to learn that I didn't know very much. That seems like a funny thing to say, I think. You know, because in general, of course, in life, you know, we don't know much. We come into the world and we don't know anything. We don't know much that we're aware of anyways. And we gain knowledge and experience and wisdom as we go along. And certainly that's true. I think that partly because I was always interested in like kind of moving to the next thing, there was a sort of
checking the box and moving on.
I don't know if it was checking the box and moving on so much as well, maybe sometimes, but I think more in terms of the big things, it was more like, okay, this has been really interesting. What's over there?
Right. Yeah, I get it. I hear you. Yeah. That's a difference. Yeah.
Kind of a little more like that.
Right.
And that meant that I've often been in situations where I felt like I should know more than I knew. And I would try to just kind of live into the knowing.
Right. You probably assumed that's what people needed or wanted from you.
I think so. Yeah. Yeah. So I became a health educator. Most of the people in that field were people with a master's in public health degree. I didn't have that. I kind of came into it through the back door, from my work as a body worker and then wanting to kind of impact people more, and started teaching and doing individual classes and ended up working for Kaiser Permanente, which is this big healthcare organization, and especially in California. And felt like I needed to know more than I knew. Just one is one of many examples in my life. And I'd kind of convinced myself that I knew more than I knew.
Mm-hmm.
So, but you know, that only will take you so far. You know, eventually you have to know what you're doing.
Right. Or, I mean, when you really learn, the more you learn, the less you know.
That's the other thing. So I finally realized that. That piece. The more you learn, the more you realize how much you don't know. So now I embrace that.
And you're more useful as a person.
I am much more useful as a person. And I am much more helpful to people.
Yeah.
You know, I've come to really embrace the not knowing and encourage other people to embrace not knowing things, to be perfectly humanly imperfect.
Which means you hurt, you're occasionally ashamed, you're sometimes guilty.
You do, and you mess up, and you fall on your face, and someone comes to you, and maybe you, or you, I was a chaplain for a number of years, and, you know, it was really important to learn this lesson, because I was sitting with people who were very vulnerable. And really, the best interactions I would have with people would always, almost inevitably, be where I just allowed myself to be in the vulnerability with them. And that meant I had to be able to find that in myself and not pretend I knew how to help them or fix them, or I could, you know, the thing that was powerful about it was just being able to sit with them and be with people.
And the use, and you can share the useful stuff, but it becomes an addition to the basis of a relationship rather than the relationship.
Yeah. So
it took me time to trust that you could spend the kind of time on a relationship that you need to just be, that those little things that I spent so much time on younger needed very little time when you had the relationship.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
When the poem, how did, can we spend a little more time with your poem? And
sure.
And that, how did it come to you? And this was, you know, this was about 30 years ago or so. How did it come to you? And when did you recognize its importance?
Well, it came to me, I actually remember really well, because I was in my training as a Feldenkrais practitioner at the time. And I was also in a challenging relationship at the time with my former partner. And the training, so I lived in the San Francisco Bay Area, and the training happened twice a year for 4 weeks for 3 years. And of course there was practice in between, but there was this intensive time together. And in the winters we would gather in San Diego. So I was in San Diego, and it was warm, and it was a beautiful day. And in the Feldenkrais method, a lot of the work and a lot of the training happens with you doing these processes on the floor, where I never know if I'm going to be able to explain this in a way that will make sense to people, but I'm going to try.
Give it a try, and I'll help.
Okay, so you are guided in movements that at first seem like you're doing nothing. There's just like oftentimes there's little micro movements. Oftentimes, so you might be. You might be lying on your back with your knees up, and one leg crossed over the other.
Mm-hmm.
And then you see, how far can I bring my knees down before they start to fall down? Like, you know, how far can I go before gravity says you're going this way?
Right.
And then there's a number of different ways that gets played with in the course of a lesson because your feet, say, for example, have ended up moving in different ways from doing those movements of your knees, and you haven't been paying attention to your feet at all, you get up on your feet and you go, oh, I'm walking differently. So it's a discovery process.
Mm-hmm.
One of the reasons I love the work so much, it was a process of discovery. Every time. It's amazing to me. So one day during one of these lessons, I got up afterwards, and there was a break, and I went outside and I started walking around, and and I realized, oh my gosh, I'm really bouncing. Oh, this is really fun. I was having a really great time. I was like really bouncing, and I walked, and suddenly me as someone who's nothing even remotely close to a basketball player, I felt like I could have just kind of bounced myself down and up like a like a pro ball player and, you know, thrown a ball into a basket. And it was just the funnest thing. And so that the and these words started coming to me, run and jump and leap and fall.
Right.
You know, and so it just kind of evolved from there. And often with this kind of poem, I have no idea what I'm saying. I just, you know, this just kind of tumbled out of me. And mm-hmm. And I didn't understand parts of it for a long time. And there's a part of it, the part that I was playing with the most before this, you know, in the last couple of days before this interview, because I was thinking chances would be maybe fun to share during this. And then I read it and I realized, but this part, this is always bugging me and I never understand what it means. And but I knew it was important. So I never took it out. I just,
right.
You know, and this time I realized that some of what I wrote doesn't match the world quite anymore. So it might still match something for mm-hmm. me, but it doesn't quite match the world anymore. So like, I'd love to take a minute with this if I
sure. Could. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Do it.
So what I noticed is that, so when I first wrote this, I wrote, we're lucky to be alive in this world rife and ripe with turmoil and possibilities at many crossroads, and our own crossroads having brought us by necessity right now. We kick down more windmills every day and leap as if walking. So there's a couple of things about this that jumped out at me. One is that our world has always had turmoil, but so much is in chaos. And like you said, so much is on fire. And actually a local pastor said something like that to me recently too. He, you know, when I was talking to him, you know, about how many things needing our attention, you know, the demise of our democracy and climate chaos. And, you know, he said, yeah, it does seem like everything's on fire all at once. And that really jumped out at me. So I just found myself feeling dissatisfied with this idea of we're lucky to be alive in this world ripe with turmoil and possibilities. Well, first of all, that was coming from my point of view as a white person who had grown up middle class, and I was struggling financially myself, but I definitely had lots of privilege. And I lived with a person who had grown up without that kind of privilege and was a person of color. And I had lived my life in a way where I knew about the turmoil and the challenges in the world. But the truth is that this poem, these words came out of me as a person with a lot of privilege. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I'm lucky to be alive in a world ripe and ripe with turmoil and possibilities. And truthfully, I do believe that we all are very fortunate to have the gift of life. Of course we are. But anyways, I realized that the chaos feels so loud,
mm-hmm.
so loud right now.
Right,
it's amplified enormously. That's I think maybe a way to say the difference.
Right, right.
It's amplified so that more of us are hearing it more loudly. We have to.
Right.
So that's one thing that stood out for me. And another thing that stood out for
can,
me.
Can I sit with that for just a second? Because what I am doing in my own spiritual and political and ethical reflection at this time uh-huh. is seeing how every 30 to 50 years in the United States since 1850, we've gone through this repetitive cycle. Mm. And the parties are essentially the same. And the people... and the people doing damage to each other on all sides are doing it in a very predictable way. And so for me, it's the first time that I get to see the cycle. So what you wrote to me feels truer without privilege per se, but just because I now have an understanding of the cyclical nature of this disaster.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much for not for for pointing that out. Yes. So like every 50 years or so.
30 to 50 years.
30 to 50 years. Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that's just an offering, because I think you could add to it what you just said, but I wouldn't strike it. And from the people of color that I have struggled with, I mean, I have lived with their struggles in the sense of in as much as anyone can share anyone else's struggle. There is always opportunity. It may be in the distance between a closed thumb and finger. The space to move may be that narrow, but there's almost always a space.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's true. I think that's well said.
So anyway, you were about to go to another topic.
No, thank you for that. I love that. I love that. Well, so when I wrote it, I wrote, we kick down more windmills every day and leap as if walking into real battles without malice or revenge. And that is, that is still an aspiration. But the windmills part is a very interesting thing to think about right now, isn't it?
Yep.
Because wasn't it smart that people realized that they could have windmills a long time ago, and that could generate water and power for them in a certain way, right? And that the wind could do that. And then we now, one of the things, of course, that one of the strategies, of course, for dealing with energy in a cleaner way is wind turbines. And so, which we kept calling windmills for a long time, just sort of generically. We don't exactly want to kick them down. That language, comes out of the Man of La Mancha, and how the hero tilted at windmills with his sword, and because he thought that it was an attacker, that the windmill was an attacker, and we obviously need something else than that. So
we also need to recognize that when we have projected an idol or a false thing there, we almost have to knock it down to see that it wasn't real.
Yes. Yes. So that's the beauty of the image of kicking down the windmill. Right? That's the beauty of the image, is that once that happens, we realize, oh, but here's what really needs our attention.
And we do not want to harm each other, but we will. We don't want to bring malice, but at times we will.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Speaking of, realizing over time how much we don't know.
Yeah. Right. And yet we're still engaged in the rhythm and the false starts and stops of life. Should we take a music break now?
We could do
Is there something that would speak to this moment?
I don't know why, but I'm thinking Big Yellow Taxi.
Okay, sure. That is a great playful response to this moment. And so here we go.
You don't know what you've got till it's gone. They paved paradise, put up a park. you've got till it's gone. The cave paradise, put up a parking lot. Late last night, I heard the screen door slam. And a big yellow taxi took away my.
This is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Rabbi Shifra Tobachman. So, Shifra, what have you learned? How have you changed? What surprised you? What did you not want to learn or resist learning that has proven to be very useful? I mean, to some extent, we've already touched on these things, but this is just another way of continuing trying to jostle those experiences that you've had that have helped you. This is how it is. This is better. This is what I can try for, or maybe even know how to do. Why did you become a rabbi so further down, so far along? I mean, maybe this is not where you're going, but at some point, I'd like to ask that question.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorting through strands of life and trying to identify, you know, which one do I want to kind of pull.
Right. We have time.
Very smart of you to have long segments with people so that they can think things through. Well, maybe I should start with the rabbi question just because it might be a little easier. I don't.
I was wondering because you want to go deeper maybe than you're ready to go right at this moment.
Yeah, maybe I'll get there from that somehow. Let's find out. We'll find out.
Sure.
So. I was going about my life with my now wife, my partner, and we had been together a number of years, 5 years maybe, 4 or 5 years, and I was going about in my professional life, in my, you know, in my career that at the time I was working at Kaiser Permanente, as I mentioned, doing health education. Largely in HIV and AIDS, and then also working in other areas of chronic disease, self-management with people and teaching and, I don't know, doing these process-oriented classes. And it was a good thing. And a lot of prevention work as well. It was good. It was good. It was good work to be able to do. I got to do some of it out in the community. And I had a health issue that needed addressing that involved surgery, ended up involving surgery. It ended up involving reproductive surgery. It wasn't cancer, it was something else, but it ended up involving reproductive surgery. And I was recovering from that. And I... I was sitting and I was meditating in my bedroom, and we were sort of in a process of moving, now that I think about it, not unlike math. We're in a process of moving. And so there was an empty closet and it had a couple hangers in it, and I had this experience of a visitor, of a non-physical visitor.
A non-corporeal visitor.
A non-corporeal visitor visiting me. And I don't know how many of your listeners I'll lose at this point, but I'll
You won't, because even many of the non-religious visitors also have an understanding of psychedelics and other experiential ways of holding the universe or being open to things that may differ, regardless of our secular or religious orientation.
Thank you, people out there. I appreciate it. So, so it was a very still day. It was a very still day. It wasn't windy. It was very still. And there was this kind of bang on the fall. So the bang was coming from one direction, and then a single hanger moved the other direction. And it was very noticeable. And I felt something, someone come into the room. Now, I haven't had a lot of experiences like this. I had some things sort of related to it, but not exactly this. And it ended up that that from this interaction with this person, the only thing that I knew, there were a lot of things I didn't know. I knew that the person looked a certain way. They looked a little like, they looked vaguely like my brother, but not at all my brother. They looked, they had these big eyes and just, you know, I don't know, just this lovely person and from a long time ago. And I don't know who they were, but they said they were from Azerbaijan. And I thought, that's strange. I don't know anything about Azerbaijan. I barely even heard the word Azerbaijan. And there was this person. I'd say, who are you? You know, I investigated, who are you? And they said that they were from Azerbaijan. And they were a child I might have had in another life, or might have had if things were different, or something along these lines. Mm-hmm. Kind of made sense. I just had reproductive surgery. I'd never really wanted to have children, but now I had no choice.
Right.
And the Azerbaijan thing really threw me. And I didn't know what this was about, really, even though I tried to find out. But when it ended and that was over and that energy had dissipated, there was only one thing I knew. And for some reason, it was that I needed to become a rabbi. It didn't really make, there was no logical progression there. There was nothing, you know, there was nothing obvious. Mm-hmm. But it was the only thing that I felt like I knew after that. And it wasn't like I had been thinking about that. Just kind of, that's what appeared. I thought that was interesting. I mean, it made a little bit of sense also in my life, because I had recently reengaged with Jewish community within the last couple of years before that. I had, you know, reengaged with Jewish community after something of a hiatus because of my life circumstances. But still, you know, there's a big leap between that and becoming a rabbi. And my lovely and practical wife said, why don't you have a bat mitzvah first? I had never done that. I had been in a secular family growing up and had not done that. And also girls were just starting to have bat mitzvahs at the time when I was that age. So that wasn't a thing that was going to happen in my milieu. And, you know, it turned out that there was a group of us in my synagogue who did that as adults together. And that was a wonderful experience. But of course, my lovely and practical wife, I think, had probably hoped that that would be the end of it.
Yes.
But actually, no, actually, it of course fed the calling in the sense, no, I think I need to keep figuring out and trying to find out how I can walk in this direction. And so I just kind of kept walking in that direction and looked for opportunities and allowed one thing to lead to another. And then when I was 59, I was ordained. To make a much longer story even shorter.
Right, but yeah. Yeah. And
There ended up being a kind of cool tie back to Azerbaijan, actually. I could tell that a little bit, which is that several, maybe how many years ago is it? Three or four years ago. My brother was clearing out my dad's house. My dad had moved to a senior residential community, and my brother was clearing out his house to sell it. And he went through my dad's desk drawer and he found this package in my dad's desk. And the package was turned out to be the cremated remains of my great uncle. Yeah, you're looking quizzically. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, why did my dad have the cremated remains of my great uncle, who was not even his great uncle? It was my mother's. It wasn't his uncle. It was my mother's uncle.
And they were cremated remains, which is highly unusual.
Cremated remains, which Jews don't usually, traditionally don't do. But
right.
But again,
do some now.
Big pieces of my family were, most of my family was secular. And my great uncle, who when he passed away lived in Florida, had wanted to be cremated. And his wife had sent the remains to my dad, who took care of lots of family matters. My mother had already passed away. He took care of lots of family matters and had asked that he bury them where my grandfather was buried, which was in a Jewish cemetery where cremated remains were not cremated.
Right.
And my dad, I imagine, probably had no idea what to do with this. He knew nothing about cremation or Jewish practice, either one. And he probably put it in the drawer, figuring, I don't know, someday it would get dealt with. And my brother, who is a devout Tibetan Buddhist, said, should I just do something with it? And I said, well, I don't know. I think we should get in touch with Uncle Aaron's daughters and see what they would like to do. We weren't close to them. We had never been close to them. So I managed to get in touch with one of them, and we ended up, and that was great. We reconnected with these cousins.
Mm-hmm.
And then it turned out that we were all able to gather in Cleveland, which is where I grew up. And we figured out a way to gather at the cemetery, and we figured out a way to mix the remains with soil. And we figured out a way to put some of them where my grandfather was buried. We had this lovely ritual and it was beautiful. And then it poured, and there was this big thunderstorm, and it poured. Mm-hmm. And it was all very dramatic and beautiful and wonderful.
And my cousin, it kindly washed away the evidence if anyone was going to.
Kindly either washed away the evidence or some little flowers were going to grow that were eventually going to get weeded and plucked out from the, from the gravestone. But it was great. It was beautiful. And it brought us together, and it was all wonderful. And so one of those cousins ended up putting me in touch with yet another cousin, who was the son of another one of the uncles. And when that cousin and I talked, he told me, my father said that his father was an itinerant salesman in the Ukraine, in the Kyiv region.
Mm-hmm.
And that he would go off on these long trips and then come back. And sometimes he'd go to Azerbaijan.
Who knew?
Who knew? You know, so I don't know. I love that. I of course, you know, did all kinds of, and I attempted to imagine, you know, what might have occurred in Azerbaijan, you know, would he have had another family in Azerbaijan?
Yes.
Could there be a sister or a or a cousin or a family member, because that would be how people would have made trade, you know. Right. Like, it was a long distance from where they lived in Ekaterinoslav, I learned was the name of the place, to Azerbaijan. But trains would have been starting to come through there. It would have been a trade route. Mm-hmm. And it would have made a lot of sense, because there was lumber and metal in one place, and there was energy production in the other place, and it, you know, would have made sense that there would have been trade between those places. So, anyways, I don't know. I don't know that I expected to tell you and your listeners all those stories.
Right. And this is the funny thing. I mean, and I've had a friend here for the last, maybe 8-10 years, who's from Azerbaijan.
So, how fun.
It's just very funny. Let's cut to music. What should we play at this moment?
You know, I don't know if I sent it to you, so I'll have to send it to you. But it's a different Sweet Honey in the Rock song. It's Memories.
Dum, dum. I know that I've been there.
This is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Rabbi Shifra Tobackman. We're getting close enough to the end of the hour that I'd like to ask you, Shifra, about your self-care. Kind of how do you take care of yourself intellectually, emotionally, physically, which I, from my point of view, adds up to spiritually, but that's my point of view. And how do you know you need to do it? And what do you do? And when people need things, I sometimes give the idea, what do you do throughout the day? What do you do daily, weekly, monthly, yearly, once in a great while? So
nice. Thank you. Oh, I like that question. So I also see these realms and pieces of self-care as
other care as well.
As one, right?
No.
I mean the internal, like the physical, emotional, spiritual, intellectual. It's all threads of one.
Right. One ball of yarn actually composed of many threads. So it's not yes. And when we do this as a person, it also situates us among other persons.
And, yes, all of that.
Yeah.
Why I like talking to you, I'm sure.
It's easy.
It's easy.
Yeah.
It's easy to not have to make that make sense. So one of the things for me is I have pretty simple morning practices. I don't do something very involved, but every morning I say a prayer that says "Moda ani lefanecha ruach chai v'kayam," which means I'm grateful to face you, spirit of life that sustains. And I think the way I think of that is I'm grateful to face you, to face my life unfolding, to face the life of the world unfolding, to look out my window and see that there's something there, to see what's happening in my own body, to notice where I'm feeling like anything but grateful, feeling grumpy or tired or irritated or, whatever it might be. But to say nonetheless, anyways, forget, whatever that all may be, but Moda ani, I'm grateful.
Right. And to face you is to face something outside of me.
Yes.
And that's an arbitrary boundary, but it means I'm here. I am. I'm ready.
Right. And of course, in tradition, what you're saying is, I'm grateful to face you, God.
Yes.
And
because that's the all.
Because that's the all, and I think of that as the all of everything life unfolding. That's the shorthand version. Although I like to not get too set in what I think God is, because I don't think any of us knows. So, but that's the general way that I approach that. And so, so that's something. Most of the time, over the years, I do some kind of movement or physical movement of some kind. That is about attention and mindfulness to what's happening for me physically. I don't practice yoga. I don't practice Tai Chi. I don't, I've been exposed to lots of things, but I've never become a practitioner, any of them. But my Feldenkrais training actually gave me an enormous amount of ability to kind of just to notice things in my own body and what's happening. So I do some movements and some other things related to that or to how I'm feeling emotionally. So lately, because there's no one around to hear me, I'll stomp and scream sometimes because it's quiet and I can do that. Or I'll just do quiet movements on the floor. Any number of things.
Right. And I really want to just highlight, these are movements that you have become aware of that you can interpret and you can follow or you can provoke because yes. of the relationship you have with your body.
Yes.
You're not, you haven't internalized the tradition of practice that you then practice, but you discover and walk through what you notice.
Yes, thank you. That's a beautiful way of saying that. I really appreciate
it. And this is, so people tend to differ in self-care from those who adopt and do the practices that they've been given by tradition and those who must, because of their personalities, find what they have inside and push it.
Yes.
And explore it and work it.
Exactly. Yes, thank you for that discernment. That's a very lovely thing to have reflected on behalf of the different ways that people do self-care and my own and reflecting my own experience. Thank you. So that's an important piece of my self-care. I like to walk. I like to, I don't know, I like to eat healthy food. I like to eat chocolate, part of my self-care.
Yeah.
It's its own food group, chocolate.
Right.
It's important to me to stay connected and clear with my partner, which we fortunately both have skill in doing with each other. I'm really grateful for that, speaking of gratitude. Shabbat is an important aspect of self-care for me, the practice of Shabbat.
So what is the practice of Shabbat?
The Jewish Sabbath. And so Shabbat is a time from Friday at sundown to Saturday at sundown in the tradition, where that's intended for rest and renewal and so for me, there's a lot involved in that for people who do it in traditional ways that I don't do, a lot of which I don't do. I don't turn off everything, for example. I don't completely shut down my technology, which people who are Shomer Shabbos, who observe more strictly, do. But I, for example, don't do email on Shabbat. I light candles always at the beginning of Shabbat. We have blessings that we say. We light candles and we bless wine or grape juice, and I do that so that I'm setting aside space. And I create a mindset for myself, whether I am at home with my partner or myself, or in community, because Shabbat traditionally is a time when people get together for prayer on Friday night and Saturday. Mm-hmm. Our community usually has some kind of service on Friday night, sometimes has a service on Saturday morning. I am happy either way. I'm happy to have a home-based Shabbat or a Shabbat with community. I really value and cherish both, actually.
Okay.
It can be a good time to connect with loved ones and friends, and so I do that. That's all part of my self-care. But I think it's just such an amazing thing that Judaism realized this need. You know, someone I knew used to say, Jews, the people who brought you the weekend.
Right.
You know, because there was a recognition, there's a need to stop work, there's a need to stop and pay attention to things in a different way.
Right. Phyllis Trible, who you may have heard of, would say, the work is not complete until you have rested from it.
Yeah, that's great. I love that. And that's how it reads when you read the creation story in the Torah or the Bible. You know, the world wasn't created in 7 days, but the seventh day was rest.
Right. Brings it wholeness. And in English, holiness, and they're close together.
Right.
Yeah.
The word shalom that lots of people know as peace, which it does mean that, also comes from the root for the word shalem, which is wholeness.
Yeah.
So it's that sense of we can't have peace without wholeness.
Right.
We can't have wholeness without rest.
Yes. Thank you.
So we say Shabbat Shalom.
Yes. Yes. And yes, it's the wishing of the wholeness that brings the peace of the day.
Right.
Yeah. Cool. What should we close the show with? This portion of the show.
Oh, boy.
The time has gone so quickly.
I know.
And I have a feeling we will have other conversations and possibly on air, because this is a way of exploring that's personal, but also much more important than personal.
Yeah, I would love that. And I loved hearing you sharing during our time together as well. Thank you.
It's a conversation more than an interview, and it took me as a chaplain. That's what I do as a chaplain, is I have a conversation with people, and we get a lot of things from each other as we give them to each other.
Right. Yeah. Very nice. Yes. One of the things I liked about chaplaincy so much. So what should we close with? How about Wonderful World?
Thank you. It's been wonderful having this conversation.
Likewise.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. The colors of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky, are also on the faces